While it is difficult to ever describe the work of the Emperor as rising from humble beginnings, said beginnings were nevertheless very difficult times. The Imperium of the late Unification Wars was a fledgling empire. Its most decisive early battles concluded, yes, but still not fully in control of the desiccated husk that was Terra. The old world was dead, a new one was struggling to be born, and yet, for a time, it was good. The greatest monsters of the Age of Strife had been felled, torn from their towers by the Master of Mankind's armies. His Imperium, as it had become known, was on course to become the first global regime humanity's cradle had seen for millennia, bringing stability and the promise of a lasting peace to a wounded and savaged planet. The Thunder Warriors, those iconic bearers of the lightning and raptor emblems of unity, who had wrought great violence in the name of their liege, and in their noble sacrifice was victory hard won. Yet within this passage into legend, the Thunder Warriors had unknowingly precipitated a brewing crisis that would come to be recorded as, to one's mind, one of the most fascinating and understudied events in the history of those early Imperial days. Know then, that this is a record of a woman who dared to dream, of a conspiracy that brewed in the heart of a nascent empire, and of its calamitous downfall. A record of the palace coup. The Emperor was already placing his stamp upon the war-ravaged continents of Terra. At the roof of the world, upon the peaks of the ancient Himalaya, a city was being built. Although even to call it a city is something of a misnomer, its eventual plans would see it rival continents. Even if, it must be noted, Terra's last ocean had long since been stolen, and the Emperor was yet bending his efforts into turning the remaining puddles back into the great seas they had once been. His palace perfectly encapsulated his thinking, or at least his public self. It was a commitment to a frankly insane effort. Even the air of those mountain peaks was unfit for human lungs, requiring localized atmospheric reconditioning that would take decades to properly render it habitable. But this was the Emperor. This was his unification. The ludicrous would be achieved because he willed it. Yet Terra was still a vicious world, still in the birthing pains of this brave new future. The most fervent of the Emperor's supporters declared loudly to all that would hear that the planet was all but united now, and only intermittent operations, undertaken largely by propagandists, economic sculptors, and, at worst, standing military forces, would be necessary to keep under control the worst of Terra's millennia-earned violent nature. Compliance was the word that had come into fashion, and the word stuck. Yet such idealism was, indeed, idealistic. While the mightiest genocide popes and sorcerer kings had been vanquished, remnants of those tyrannical polities, and powers far older still, nursed their festering wounds and poisonous ideologies in hidden holdfasts and occluded bunkers across the globe. Others still remained deluded and vocal in their opposition, unwilling to accept the seismic changes that the new Imperium was effecting upon the world. They believed in many things: creeds, religions, traditions, cultures, all of which the Imperium was, without discrimination, steamrolling into oblivion. Belief itself was the issue. I teach the end of belief. I am its terminus, its replacement. After me, there will only be perception, a sight of the single truth, glimpsed from a distance. Thus were the words of this new emperor. And when the emperor declared something, that thing often had a habit of being made to happen. The palace was thus a statement in rockcrete and plasteel, a manifesto written upon the roof of the world for all, metaphorically and physically, to raise their gazes up in order to look upon the words and works and sheer intent of their emperor. Human hands were building this. Human hands guided by a singular individual that, for all his seemingly unstoppable will, was by his own profession as human as they. This cognitive dissonance was never seemingly an issue for the emperor, preferring to leave that to the work of the earliest iterators to smooth it out. He was no god, he declared, merely a king, a deliverer, a champion of a species who had lost so much, yet deserved so much more. A king needed a palace, and the king of the world needed a palace like no other. For millennia, Terra had been a world whose rulers squatted in the remnants of the past, within crumbling hive cities or dingy citadels, meager ruins of glories long gone. The palace embodied a vision. An era unlike any other required works unlike anything ever achieved. The palace was a promise of what was to come. If this was what humanity could accomplish on a homeworld torn asunder for thousands of years, what more could it achieve in the great undiscovered country of the future? It would, of course, project dominance, too, as a happy side effect. It was still a fortress, an impossible keep atop mountains a scant percentage of humans who had ever lived had managed to summit. No enemy, unless they be suicidal beyond reason, would ever attempt to assail such a citadel. Yet, as records of the time show, there still was dissension. Many upon Terra secretly, or not so secretly, strained under the new order. Scraps of chronicles one has parsed, conducted by those earliest of imperial academics, speak of interviews where some nominally loyal imperial subjects professed to occasionally miss the old world that was passing from their lives day by day, idly stating that this new imperium was an austere place of law and order, far removed from the chaotic freedoms they remembered. If one is permitted to editorialize for a moment, such writing speaks to that most pernicious aspect of the human psyche, nostalgia. However else could someone on Unification-era Terra think of the past with any degree of fondness? How could an individual, safe for the first time, chafe under the Lex Pacificus when they no longer risked dying of cancers at 30 years old, their genes soured by radiological munitions lacing their homelands, or flee from the onset of a mendicant nanoplague, or have their communities impressed into genetic slavery at the hands of this or that psycho-tyrant? Certainly those of Terra had never known the grip of centralized authority as rigid as that of the Emperor's rule. People learned a deference to a sole individual in numbers not seen in an epoch. Such rule provided structure. It gave one's life borders, whereas the anarchy before had, one must charitably assume, come with a degree of freedom that would no longer exist, even if the price of freedom must have been measured in countless lives spent in torture, torment, and agony. While one feels this mindset is immature in the extreme, your humble servant must beg one's acolytes to bear in mind that this is to be considered as the events of this record proceed to unfold. It should, of course, be noted that the central figure this chronicle concerns itself with did not, by any means, harbor misplaced romanticism for the Terran past. She was, if anything, a product of all of the good that Unity had brought to the human homeworld. Uwama Kandawire was born in the Banda Confederacy of Sud Afrik during the early years of the Unification Wars, a time when the Emperor was just one of many warlords vying for regional territories. a region of relative stability, Kandawire's family was of moderately wealthy means, affording her a childhood of comparative peace and happiness in her family's secure compound. Her father, a man who prized learning, ensured his daughter had access to whatever educational material he could furnish her with, including many ancient texts on Terran history, society, and politics, all of which must have seemed nigh stranger than fiction. Nevertheless, the ideas of her schooling, as well as her personal curiosity, developed within the young Kandawire a fierce dedication to justice and the rule of law. For the books she voraciously consumed spoke of times in Terra's distant past where the people, not the warlords, dictated right and wrong through mutually agreed and enforced codes of law, where justice flowed from a mandate from the masses and not from the barrel of a gun. Such safety as she enjoyed, however, was as fleeting as it could possibly be upon Terra. The raids and warring that so consumed the planet were as unpredictable as the now stolen oceans had been, and eventually they reached her family's compound, forcing them to flee. She eventually found her way into the realms of the Lord of Lightning, as the Emperor had become known, and found within his burgeoning imperium hope. Hope for a better future, a future where violence would no longer be the ultimate arbitrator, merely a grim necessity in order to bring about security. For, as her father had always said, whenever the warrior is in charge, things stopped working. For things to work, the warrior is the servant of the worker. The worker makes things work. Kandawire arrived with an auspicious sense of timing, becoming involved with the first iteration of what would eventually become the Adeptus Arbites, lawkeepers of the Emperor's territories and his Lex Pacifica, the first legal framework to be broadly applied across continents and cultures since before the Age of Strife. She rose rapidly through the ranks thanks to her cunning and insight, but also humility, personability, and an immovable sense of justice. Kandawire abhorred the might-makes-right mindset so ingrained within the Terran psyche. She worked fiercely on behalf of underrepresented groups and minorities within the Emperor's realm, becoming a fiery voice of reform within the Imperium's burgeoning civilian apparatus. Said apparatus, of course, was a lateral creation. In its earliest days, the Imperium had only ever needed generals. The Emperor, omnipresent, was more than capable of handling affairs of state governments, scant as they may have been, alongside his mysterious vizier, Malkador. Without them, there was no Imperium. Their fates were utterly intertwined. And certainly without them, those early efforts, those humble beginnings one has alluded to, would surely have collapsed. Then, of course, there was Constantine Valdor, third of that triumvirate, first of the Legio Custodes, Captain General of the Emperor's Life Wards. Valdor was the Emperor's ultimate bodyguard, but also a living icon of the Imperium, as if a standard of battle could be a person. It has never been established if Valdor is the first Custodes ever created, or merely the first successful iteration of their kind. The bioalchemy and genetic artistry of their creation was an especial aspect of the Emperor's personal genius, and between that and records being so scant, we will likely never know for certain. Below these three individuals, there had essentially been an amorphous mass of everything else. Warriors, soldiers, mercenaries, scientists, logistocrats, laborers, all formed the Imperium. But there had been little in the way of formal state apparatus as any historiator could identify it. The Imperium was, in those earliest days, a movement, not an empire. There were no statesmen to advise and represent. What possible advice could mortals provide this trio of titans? Who could represent them better than they themselves? For they needed no rest, seemingly, and could be everywhere they were needed. But the triumvirate could not rule in totality, not over everything, not over a planet. and armies certainly could not rule in their stead. Cities fell, then kingdoms, then continents. Hundreds of subjects became thousands, then became millions, and the emperor's plan had been clear from the beginning. The methods of the past were to return. Rule by law, not violence or religion, was the credo of the Imperium. This led to the inception of the Office of the Magisters Temporal, rulers and administrators for the Imperium's first Terran provinces, tasked with the security and taxation of these newly stabilized regions. These were in turn eventually administered by the Lord Civilian, a higher office who were responsible for groups of provinces. The initial system was unwieldy and wholly insufficient. The birth pains of a newborn administration on a planet that had not seen one so complex for millennia. It was barely able to keep up with the demands of the population it was nominally beholden to. Food riots and currency runs were common, as the demands of the Emperor's armies were always seen to supersede civilian concerns, and these demands could change in an instant. This system proceeded for approximately 70 years from its inception, lasting in its stuttering, ad hoc form until the foundations of the palace were becoming solid and the time and effort were spared to develop a more formal and secure system of internal governance. A major leap forward in this regard was the codification of the Lex Pacifica, the predecessor to the modern Lex Imperialis, developed, it was said, by the hand of Malkador and based on legal scriptures of truly ancient origin. The Lords Civilian were now overseen by a higher body still, the first four High Lords Civilian. These High Lords were not, however, responsible for provinces or groups thereof, but for specific facets of government, much like the ministers of the regimes of Old Earth. They were, initially, the Master of the Administratum, the Chancellor of the Estate Imperium, the Lord Commander Militant of the Imperial Armies, and the Provost Marshal of the Divisio Arbites, responsible, in order, for bureaucracy, treasury, military, and law. Even to those individuals who first held the offices, it was unsure this pattern would last, or if these High Lords would eventually be superseded by a yet higher authority. These were unstable days. The Imperium was growing ever more secure, but Terra, once again, was still a dangerous place. There were forms of governments from the distant past that were not resurrected in this new imperial age. Democracy, that most proletarian of systems, was never considered. A mandate of the masses was neither required nor desired. The Imperium was fundamentally a dictatorship, a military junta, with the Emperor needing nor desiring no input from the people he ruled with a largely benevolent but ironclad hand. His promise, and it must be acknowledged, deliverance of stability and security, did the rest. There was a great sense in surviving records of the time of relief, of even the wisest and most insightful members of the new empire accepting the promise of personal safety, health, and relative prosperity for the surrender of many important but distant freedoms. A gamble that such liberties were worth risking for a life led without fear of marauding gene raider bands. It was not that civilians were without representation or power. It was merely that said power flowed from the top of an extremely pointed pyramid. Thus, the new High Lords were far from bereft of authority, and were no mere figureheads. Each was fully expected to apply themselves, their skills, and their political capital to the betterment of the imperial regime, to allocate its meager resources, rebuild its shattered infrastructure, see to the health and succor of its subjects, and to enforce its laws. As Noam Retrievia, the first master of the Administratum, said, "They are the sword, we are the quill. There is an old saying concerning the relative might of each, but I forget its precise formulation." Retrievia is indeed a perfect example of the type of individual that would prosper under a regime such as the early Imperium. A descendant of ancient mercantile clans of the American West Coast, his lineage had survived the atomic shattering of that region thanks to their absolutely staggering wealth, which they had shepherded through thousands of years of instability and warfare with a vicious dedication. Metravia had pledged to the Imperium willingly. A family such as his knew power when they saw it, and had raised their scions accordingly. The clan's extremely valuable technology, proprietary in many respects, and armored fighting regiments had been a huge boon to the Emperor's power projection within that region of Terra. And for it, Retravia was due for a position of standing. Happily for all concerned, and despite his deeply cynical drive for personal enrichment, Retravia was a political animal and a superlatively skilled logistician. Through full application of his talents and leadership, the Administratum grew exponentially, deepening its reach and its efficiency with each passing year. It was through Retravia that the Imperium came upon its first Chancellor of the Estate Imperium, Pelops Dravagor, who, as master of coin and taxation, was in lockstep with the Administratum in almost every capacity. To attempt to balance the scales, Malkador had installed Cli San Wea as Lord Commander Militant, ensuring that all diktats of the military regime could be communicated smoothly and with as little personal input as possible. This, of course, left Uwama Kandawire, Provost Marshal, risen through office by a series of machinations, yes, and bold public moves, that even her own writing she finds difficult to recall the sequence of. She was neither a lauded commercial magnate, reformed warlord, dynastic inheritor, or political animal. Prior to her ascension to one of the highest offices in the land, she had been a notable but relatively minor prosecutor in the palace's burgeoning tribunals, who, for whatever reason, had caught the eye of the Sigilite. It can nominally be said that Kandawire was an appointee of Malkador, yet it must be acknowledged that she rarely behaved as such during her time in office. While Lord Commander Wea, a remarkably competent general, still took orders without question from the Emperor, Sigilite, and Captain General, Kandawire would frequently find herself at loggerheads with her supposed benefactors, insisting on finding alternative paths to law enforcement when many called for indiscriminate and heavy-handed use of force. It is notable that, for all the essentially oversightless power over civil order she had, there was never anything approaching an authoritarian streak within her. Her reformist tendencies were ever at the fore, and while it is beyond doubt many would consider her to have been a bleeding heart, the impressions of others never seemed to bother her. The warrior is a servant of the worker. That was her mantra, and her relentless pursuit of this must be borne in mind as one of the major catalysts for events to come. At some indeterminate point in the years following its occurrence, Uwama Kandawire pursued an especially private investigation into the Battle of Mount Ararat. Imperial history upon this era, scant as it is, has startlingly little to say about that calamitous clash of armies. What is curious is that even amongst what records have survived until our present era, concrete information is scarce. Some records refer to it as the final battle of unification. This is false. Smaller conflicts continued to be waged across Terra following it. To make an analogy, Mount Ararat was, for all intents and purposes, the Unification War's Ulanor. It seems the battle was a decisive blow against a foe that could possibly have been the last power on Terra to pose an existential risk to the Imperium. Even this, however, is presumptive. Your most humble of learned servants must beg your forgiveness. We currently have no means of establishing precisely who all 20 legions of Thunder Warriors were dispatched to engage. All we do know is that which Imperial public missives declared. The heroic embodiment of the ideals of unity, the Thunder Warriors, they who had shed so much blood, every soldier of the Legio Cetacea had perished at the battle. the Imperium would now endure, thanks to their sacrifice. Delivered to the apex of global domination, the Emperor's future was at hand. The wars from here on would be formalities of enforced capitulation. What is deeply interesting to this is that this was only a laterally established narrative. In the months following the battle's aftermath, it was as if the Thunder Legions had simply vanished. No reports were delivered to other branches of the Imperial military of their movements and deployments. No doubt many assumed that a security protocol has been changed, but others grew quietly alarmed. Reports of substantial losses within the Thunder Legion were acknowledged, but they still technically existed, but only on paper. Another form of cognitive dissonance that the Emperor was clearly demanding of his subjects, and one that the Imperial household was simply not addressing. Even this narrative, however, conflicts with established history. We know from the sundry tales of later deployments of the original Legiones Astartes upon Terra that the planet was far from unified. While threats of truly existential danger may not have existed in the same quantity, there nevertheless remained pockets of resistance, recalcitrant regimes, and runaway technology that required the deployment of transhuman, genetically augmented troops. The loss of the entirety of the Legio Contagious should have been presented as a massive military emergency for Imperial command. And yet, the 20 legions, barring isolated units unable to deploy to Anatol in time for the battle, was accepted from the top down as a transition period. The regime's messaging seemed perfectly at ease with the idea that Terra, for all its sorcerous horrors and rampant archaeotech, could be tamed by the regiments of baseline soldiery that formed the Imperial Army. The dissonance did not pass entirely unnoticed. It was no doubt accepted by the masses. One has already touched upon in this record that subservience to the Imperium, the towing of the regime's line, was becoming extremely common across Terra's traumatized populations. But there remained individuals with the ken to understand that all was not right, that, depleted even as they were by centuries of warfare in his name, as well as their rumored genetic instability, 20 whole legions of transhumans could not have vanished overnight. Equally suspicious, for those within the higher spheres of authorities, was the closure of the site to all access. The Imperial household had placed its stamp upon the orders. There was the sheer silence, the refusal to acknowledge that, seemingly overnight, tens of thousands of the Imperium's most famous warriors had simply disappeared, even behind the authority of the Imperial household. It is likely that many read those signs, who regarded the disconnect between public statements and official secrecy, and merely turned away from it, accepting the state line that the legacy of the Thunder Warriors would now forever be as martyrs to unity. Uwama Kandawire was not one of those people. Exercising the full authority of her office, Kandawire launched a secret investigation into the destruction of the Legio Contagious, even managing to deploy teams of trusted invigilators to the site of the battle and visiting it herself. What this team discovered shook her to her core. Fragments of Oromite, the composite material that, while appearing gold, was anything but. Only one organization in the entire planet was permitted its use, for its quality and rarity mandated it only be used for the finest of armor, that worn by the Legio Custodes. Official records make absolutely no indication of the Legio's deployment at Mount Ararat, yet there was evidence that custodians had taken part in the conflict to such a degree that even their faultless armor had been damaged. With the official blockade of tangible information, the totality of contagious losses, and the seeming hand of the Imperial household itself upon all things involved, Kandawire was forced to reach a conclusion. The Legio Custodes had, without seemingly any consultation with the wider Imperium, exterminated an entire army of the Empire's military, and were seemingly mounting a concentrated cover-up in its aftermath. Such an act flew in the face of everything the Imperium purportedly stood for. Yes, the Emperor's terms for enemies were absolute: comply or be destroyed. But for the entirety of the regime's existence, it had been predicated on the understanding that all who pledged to the Raptor and Lightning Banner were as one, defenders of hope and progress on a world that sorely needed both. For Kandawire, the act recalled the descent into absolute barbarity that the Imperium was supposed to have set itself against, the rule of the powerful by violence alone, the behavior of petty warlords. It was everything the Age of Strife had been, now apparently come anew. It is, of course, easy for those of us in the present era to view Kandawire's conclusion as one drawn from hopeless idealism, a seeming childish naivety about the regime she served. Such thinking is presentism of its worst kind. The first Provost Marshal was as much a product of her age as the Thunder Warriors themselves. She was a creation of that benighted Terran epoch, yet one who refused to submit to the temptations of expediency and dared to dream of progress and betterment. Progress, it must be said, that the Emperor had made a central tenet of the Imperium since its inception. Kandawire was no fool. From all records we have of her personal journals, miraculously preserved by the Imperial Household Archives themselves, she was fully aware of the conflict between her reformist tendencies and the military dictatorship she served. Yet, within the stability of the Emperor's apparently benevolent authoritarianism, she saw potential, an opportunity such as the homeworld had not seen for millennia. Much scorn has oft been heaped upon those who struggle within such systems, labor to effect change even as they submit to authority. One cannot pronounce upon this point of debate, save for the maxim of what path was there better. The fact remains that passing judgment upon Kandawire's, well, judgment, is futile and ignorant. For all that was to transpire, she was a woman of solid conviction, who was attempting to make the world she cared for a better place for those without the ability to do so themselves. At its core, the apparent massacre of the Thunder Warriors, without any consultation with the High Lords, possibly even the Emperor, was an untenable breach of the Lex Pacifica. The law, it must be remembered, she herself was charged to keep and enforce, by whatever means she saw fit. Uama Kandawire was no fool. She was diligent in her devotion to the codes of justice her father had raised her upon. Evidence must be gathered, beyond the fragments of Oromite recovered at the battle site, and should that be insufficient, force gathered to project her authority. She was under no aspersions of the world Terra still was. As deplorable as it may have seemed, Kandawire was well aware that if the conspiracy she was investigating was indeed of the nature she suspected, it would only be possible to contain with the threat of violence, the proverbial stick behind the rule of law. She was facing what amounted to a coup d'état by the Legio Custodes, a seemingly unilateral move by the military arm of the household against the Emperor and the Imperium. She would need allies, and within these allies we find equally fascinating insights into her character and judgment. Through means unrevealed, she was able to establish contact with a Thunder Warrior remnant of the 4th Legio Cetacus, the Iron Lords, led by one of the apparently sole surviving Primarchs, a warrior named Ushotan. It must be noted to acolytes that, be you unfamiliar with the term, during the Unification Wars, the Primarchs of the Cetacus were not those of the Legiones Astartes, possessing abilities beyond that of their genetically adherent sons. No, they were more akin to generals, no necessarily different from those they led beyond exceptional strategic acumen, or, as was more common with the era, skills of personal combat and sheer brutality. Ushotan led a force of Thunder Warriors that had escaped the fate that had befallen their fellows, To say that revenge was a prime motivator for the Primarch was an understatement. Yet it must also be noted that Ushertan was a warrior of honor, at least to the ideals of unity. Canderwire's records note his contagious subordinates, many who already seemed in the beginnings of grand mal genetic apoplexy, retained the Raptor banners they had served under. The Primarch himself pledged to spare the civilians an innocence that may become caught in any possible crossfire, and that even said violence would only occur if the High Lord herself ordered it. Per his own words, "We never broke our oaths. What makes you think we would do so now?" The final member of Canderwire's movement, albeit the most independent and indeed unlikely, was the scientist Amar Astarte, head of the Emperor's biotechnical division. Astarte's career had begun in Age of Strife Terra, as a mercenarial genewright serving at the whims of various Terran despots, surviving purely on the value of her knowledge, making her indispensable. The monstrosities she crafted committed great atrocities, it is beyond doubt, almost all of which she was insulated from by virtue of her station within this petty kingdom or that, but never far from the proverbial gates. Within the Emperor's fledgling realm, she found not only security, but extremely fertile ground, as the Lord of Lightning's genetic engineering projects were beyond the scope of even her wildest imaginations. Her talent was immediately recognized by the Emperor, and this genius he shackled to what was his greatest work, the creation of the Primarchs. Astarte's input was fundamental to their creation. The Emperor's genius, and that of other individuals one is currently conducting researches upon, was harnessed alongside Astarte's to create 20 beings. Transhuman demigods, upon whose fate the galaxy would change. Yet, as any student of this period of history knows, the project met with disaster. The 20 infants were scattered into the warp, believed at the time to be lost. Astarte, alongside Constantine Valdor and other members of the Custodes, was able to frantically recover their genetic data, enough to allow for the second phase of the project, the creation of the Legiones Astartes, to be able to proceed. It would be hampered by the loss of the infants, of course, but she and the Emperor, at the time, believed it was still possible. In the decades that followed, Amar Astarte drew, at first disillusioned, then spiteful, and ultimately hateful, of her role within the Imperial Genetic Engineering Program. By the time she and Canderwire came into contact, Astarte had been leading the creation of the legions that would yet come to bear her very name, for long enough to have developed the conviction that the project was doomed. It was certain she was aware of the Emperor's own convictions on the Thunder Warriors, that they had been a short-term solution to the problem that was the unification of Terra, and the Imperium's lack of resources. She was now convinced that, without the Astartes Primarchs, nothing could be done to stabilize this new breed of genetically enhanced warrior, and they would be susceptible to the same total cellular and mental breakdown that the Contagious had been. She had some awareness of the true scope of the Emperor's ambitions, that much is almost certain, that of his plans to bring his Imperium beyond the light of Sol, that of his opposition to the arch-enemy of primordial annihilation, perchance, maybe even to the work beginning in the deepest reaches of the dungeon. She believed that the Master of Mankind's impatience would doom humanity, that in his rush to bring his war to the stars with fundamentally flawed and unstable creations, even though she had bent her very life in attempting to cure them, that the Emperor would damn humanity for all eternity. Armed with this total despair, she moved to set herself against his plans, ending them before they could even be fully started. She did not, and it is crucial to bear this in mind, inform Canderwire of any of this. It appears that, for Astarte, The Provost Marshal and her convictions were merely a useful patsy, an ally of convenience. It is certain that, given her position and influence within the Emperor's most inner circles, the Director knew the final fate of the Thunder Warriors, and, one must surmise, agree with the actions taken by the Legio Custodes. She cared little for Valdor and his golden kin, and did not likewise care if they were held to account under such petty considerations as the legality of their actions. Astarte merely wished to use Canderwire to provide cover for her own moves. The total destruction of all Legiones Astarte's genetic material, destroying the entire gene seed reserve and all associated data, lest anyone be able to recreate the project. She was phenomenally confident of her input, that without her, there would have been no Primarchs, no gene seed to create their sons. Your most humble servant must concede that this is a high likelihood. Much has been made of the Emperor's peerless genetic genius, yet his was not the only genius to have survived the Age of Strife. He merely did so within one body. Science beyond his endured that epoch. One need only reference the life of Basilio Foe as proof. Astarte was resolved in her course, and had no doubt that it would claim her life. She reckoned this a fair price to pay in stopping what she believed was a course that had set humanity upon the road to damnation. Canderwire, O'Shotan, and Astarte. These were the leaders and enactors of the palace coup. As with many coups throughout history, the instigators possess vastly different reasons for their especial grievances against the ruling regime, willing to work alongside one another, and yes, deceive one another, to accomplish their own specific objectives. Canderwire, despite her co-conspirator's collar, would not make her move until she had obtained what she considered conclusive proof, delivered to her by none other than Constantin Valdor himself, through personal testimony. Deposing and interrogating the Captain General under the tenets of the Lex Pacifica, something the warrior himself consented to, Canderwire confronted the custodian with the sole piece of information Astarte had been willing to bequeath to her. The creation of what Astarte had misleadingly told the Provost Marshal were new generals for the Legio Cattagius, referring, one assumes, to the Primarchs. Valdor, to her surprise, was remarkably candid about the failure of that particular project, even giving the Provost Marshal a full account of the day of its spectacularly destructive obliteration, although, and it must be noted, omitting what had been established as being the perpetrators of the particular incident. He did not reveal the precise nature of the Astartes Primarchs, merely stating, to an extent truthfully, that the goal had been the elimination of genetic instability, and the creation of a new, far more reliable soldier for the wars to come. Canderwire, confronting him directly about the lack of information about Thunder Warrior movements, and about precisely what happened on Mount Ararat, was curtailed, with Valdor ending the interrogation unilaterally. For Canderwire, this was all the proof that she needed. The worst of her suspicions had been confirmed. Legio Custodes, and at the very least Constantin Valdor, had operated under their own interests, and, fearing lack of prestige amongst the Imperium and lack of power with the rise of these new generals, had moved against the Imperium and its laws. The members of the coup had not sought to obtain this information lightly. The Provost Marshal had ensured that, as soon as she had proof she needed, her move could be made immediately, with as much haste as possible. She had carefully ensured O'Shotan's forces, alongside a host of disaffected or disbanded Imperial Army regiments, were covertly moved into positions close to the site of the Imperial Palace in Himalaya. As soon as Canderwire's final interview with Valdor was abruptly concluded, she ordered their movements on the palace grounds, while simultaneously dispatching her Arbites forces to ensure the seclusion and safety of the civilian and laborer populations, wishing no harm to come to them in the coming coup d'etat. Simultaneously, Amar Astarte ordered the deployment of the Castellan Exemplars Regiment of the Imperial Army to secure her route through the Imperial Dungeon to the Gene Seed vaults. The exemplars were, in almost every respect, baseline humans, save for one vital augmentation: their absolute and utter genetic devotion to Astarte and her will. The entire regiment had been one massive contingency plan for the Director, their entire lives slaved to her. It had been a phenomenal effort on her part, networking in absolute secrecy the works of hundreds of fertility clinics across dozens of Terran provinces, all modified following their conception with Astarte's most subtle genetic engineering. All of these individuals now finding themselves drawn to service in this one specific regiment. Every exemplar was aware of their nature, taught by Astarte, and later their fellows, to prevent any potential unpleasant revelations in later life, although none were ever made unhappy by it. This was, of course, a product of their genetic enhancement. For Astarte was far too skilled to leave something like that to free will. The exemplars were activated en masse, and moved with all the professionalism of their storied regiment. This precise coup was not the reason for their creation. Astarte never had that great a plan, beyond the paranoid need for an ultimate armed contingency, but they would serve her well, nevertheless. The palace was, at the time, sparsely defended. It was still in large part under construction. The grand dome of what was to become the Senatorum Imperialis was a mere shell, awaiting completion. The air itself had not been properly terraformed, often requiring the use of breathing apparatuses for baseline humans to move outdoors comfortably, and pressurized buildings to permit a relatively comfortable interior existence. It was far from any of the ongoing conflicts, situated at the heart of the Imperium's core territories. It was at the very roof of the world, such that even accessing it was a challenge. No great force of arms was deployed within its borders. There was simply no need for any. The Emperor was elsewhere, while the Sigilite was conducting a diplomatic mission to Luna. None of the Imperium's remaining enemies would be so bold and so foolish to strike against it, even without the Emperor in attendance. A skeleton garrison of squads from honored Imperial Army regiments, Astarte's own exemplars, the arbitrators of the Provost Marshal, and whatever members of the Legio Custodes were in residence at the time, were all considered to be more than sufficient for the palace's security. Now, it was the Custodes who were on the front line. It was at the very gate of the Senatorum that Constantin Valdor took to the field to treat with the architects of the coup. Ranged against him was a host of Thunder Warriors, modified mercenaries and their armored vehicles, all led by Ushotan and Uwama Candlewire. The High Lord demanded the Captain General's immediate surrender for crimes against the state, accusing him of the extermination of loyal Imperial forces to ensure the continued primacy of his Legio Custodes. She asserted that all his rights, the rights of every Imperial subject under the Lex, would be fully respected, that if he was innocent of these accusations, he would have naught to fear. Valdor's rebuke was delivered with his customary unsentimentality. In a prosaic statement, he dismissed Candlewire's accusations, not because they weren't true, but because terms such as innocent or guilty were meaningless to one such as he, an architect of the species. No crime committed by the Imperium was too great if it made safe the future of humanity. The end, by the Captain General's word, would fundamentally justify the means. The Lex, she cited, and had served, was a tool of psychological control, a means for the powerful to exert social control over their new populations. At best, it was a codified expression of the Emperor's will. He labeled Candlewire a fool for having believed it to the degree that she had, and that the true lesson of his interviews with her had been just that, of necessity, of the Emperor's ambitions, and what those ambitions had wrought. There would always be armies, and the newest one was about to take to the field. The deployment of the First Legion, latterly the Dark Angels, by Constantin Valdor was an act of singular historical import, and one redolent with symbolism that went far beyond their outstanding military efficacy. In their first combat operation, the newborn Astartes were tasked with the obliteration of the last of their predecessors. Sent to battle, those that had won so much of Terra for the Emperor, but who were rapidly passing into the fading history pages as the Master of Mankind's designs grew ever larger. As soon as they took to the field, the fate of the palace coup was sealed. But in truth, its fate had been sealed long before that point. Nothing escapes the eyes of the Legio Custodes. Candewire's investigations and ideations had been observed keenly from the very beginning. The lack of garrisoning of the palace, the odd combination of honesty and intransigence from Valdor during his interviews with the Provost Marshal, and the delivery of crumbs of evidence to her agents had been orchestrated with all the precision the Imperial household was known for, in order to bait and reveal potential usurpers within. And, as a happy byproduct, provide the Legiones Astartes their first combat test, one which they were now passing with flying colors. The Thunder Warriors of Ushotan made an admirably brave final stand, even inflicting some casualties upon their successors. Yet all were slaughtered to a man, alongside the Imperial Army agitators that had joined them. The contagious Primarch himself fell in single combat with Constantine Valdor, one of the last of his kind to bleed upon the surface of Terra. Pitying the custodian for the sheer lack of pleasure or meaning that such a victory would bring. Within the Imperial dungeon, the defiance of Amar Astarte had, likewise, been under the monitoring of the custodes, with the custodian Simonis intervening on behalf of the household to stymie the director's plans. Slaughtering his way through the exemplars, Simonis confronted Astarte within the vault of the Astartes gene seed, the sum total of the project's genetic archives of all 20 legions, priceless beyond all imagining. According to Legio records, Astarte declared despairingly to Simonis that the entire endeavor was doomed, that the Emperor's plans would lead only to ruin, and that she could no longer countenance such a thing. She detonated an explosive device, consuming the genetic archive in its entirety. It had been Valdor's stated aim that the director be given every opportunity to turn from the course the custodes believed that she had committed herself to, even if one doubts all involved ever believed that such repentance was possible. Her suicide bought her nothing, not even within Legacy. The Emperor had, of course, been unwilling to risk his ambitions upon results developed in a single location, as he had with the Primarch project. He had made a full genetic backup of all Astartes' gene seed datas and samples, off-site, delivered to allies upon Luna before the eventual full pacification of the Selenar gene cults. Astartes' name, of course, remained upon the project, indelibly linked to the Imperium's greatest feat of genetic engineering, even to this day. As to the Emperor's reasoning for this, we can only make suppositions. As Malkador the Sigilite once mused, the Master of Mankind did seem to enjoy these little ironies. The palace coup has, in one's estimation, received shockingly little attention from Imperial historians, despite the fact that it serves as an amazingly detailed portrait of the Imperial model of governance in microcosm. At a time when there were still active conflict zones upon Terra, and even control of near-orbital space around the throne world was far from secure, a full-scale internecine conflict between two of the most powerful militarized branches of the nascent Imperium passed without any direct or public involvement of the Emperor himself, or even the Sigilite. Let us be under no uncertain terms. The hands of the latter were involved in his customarily distant fashion, and one would never be bold enough to claim that the Master of Mankind knew nothing of an attempt by the director of his most prized project to smother his ambitions in their genetic cradles. Yes, their actual presence is starkly absent, physical in the case of both the Emperor and Malkador, as well as metaphorical. But both were clearly content to trust their servants in the Legio Custodes to conduct themselves accordingly, which one will admit they did so to their customary standards of perfection. Even the custodian Simonas, failing as he did to prevent Amar Astarte from destroying the Terran gene seed archive, still succeeded within the parameters that Valdor had envisaged for the operation. He ultimately wished to draw Astarte out, letting her remove herself from the proverbial picture, believing she had fully succeeded. We have, or at least the Imperial household possesses, a significant amount of documentary evidence for all of this, from Custodes' records and testimony, to Legiones Astarte's after-action reports, to Arbiti's cleanup data. This material, firstly, leaves little doubt as to the actual involvement on the part of the Emperor. Valdor's own testimony, penned by the Captain General subsequent to the coup, indicates explicitly that his investigation and eventual liquidation of the Provost Marshal and her allies was not even communicated to the Master of Mankind. And subsequent discussions between Valdor and Malkador indicate no such communication was ever expected. Yet, this is, in and of itself, consent on behalf of the Master of Mankind. The machinations inherent to this entire calamitous episode speak to the inherent fallacy of the Lex Specifica, and its later successor, the Lex Imperialis. Candewire was perhaps the first of her kind to realize that the Lex does not function as a true legal body, and was never designed to do so. Like the title of the absentee sovereign, the Lex served, and continues to serve, to project the illusion of legitimacy and stability that compensated for the Imperium's lack of anything resembling a coherent body politic. It ensured that there were no meaningful constraints placed upon the Imperial household and its proxies, said proxies being, of course, whatever the Emperor or the Sigillite happened to require. Far from any actual social or legal foundation, the Lex Specifica was a mote of smoke designed to obscure a fundamentally unsteady political apparatus. People of the age, it has been pointed out previously, were seemingly desperate for structure. In many cases, this was a willing accedance to authority. In the case of Candewire, it was a desperation for an order that brought a semblance of justice for the weak over the powerful. A hint that there may, just may, be some hope for a human civilization in this benighted age. In this light, one cannot help but wonder if the insistence that, quote, the Lex is everything, a statement extensively attributed to Malkador the Sigillite by both contemporaries and members of his so-called Chosen, represented a moment of profound candor from the old regent. It also leads to inevitable questions around the intentionality of the construction of the Imperium itself, and indeed the inevitable conclusion that it was, and has ever been, a means to serve the Emperor's ultimate aims. Candewire, of course, knew nothing of this, at all. Even Amar Astarte was likely unaware of the Golden Throne and what lay behind and beyond it. As the destruction of the Gene Archives and the later securing of Luna freed space within the Imperial Dungeon for that altogether grander project. This was design. The deliberate ignorance the Emperor and his closest cultivated in those below them was in order to extract their knowledge, labor, and service. The Imperium, like the palace the coup attempted to take, was a statement of intent, a massive laboratory, and a fortress, all within which one man sought to harness a species to enact his will. One cannot help but admire Uoma Candewire. She was, for all her faults, a woman of an idealism that had long since departed Terra, a figure who was attempting to do what none had done for millennia, to build, to make a world where the weak were able to bring the powerful to some measure of account, to elevate humanity beyond the barbarism that had defined it for so long, to bring about a world where words could matter more than a gun. It is, as one has said, only with the benefit of 10,000 years of hindsight are we allowed to even think about judging her. Hers was not a naivety to one's mind, but merely a belief in what was possible. her sin, if it could even be called that, was daring to believe, just for a moment, that the Emperor was actually who he claimed to be, rather than merely another altogether singular version of countless men throughout our history who have believed themselves above their fellow humanity, believed the demands of their vision and ego supersedes everything around them. Those scholars that heap scorn upon her for such a belief are projecting their cynicism as a means of self-defense, lest they be forced to admit to themselves that they have simply accepted their place within an empire that apes legitimacy for the sake of a more total repression than can possibly be imagined. Had the world had more people like Uama Candlewire, one can only wonder as to what future we may have come to inhabit, far removed from this rotten thing pretending to be an empire. Ave Imperator. Gloria in excelsis terra. This video and this channel were made possible thanks to the very kind donations and support from my Patreon subscribers. If you'd like to help support the channel, head on over to patreon.com/oculusimperia. If you'd like to receive more updates about the channel and any future videos, you can contact me or follow me on Twitter @oculusimperia. Otherwise, please like, subscribe, comment, let me know your feedback, and as ever, thank you very much for watching.